you would realize that almost all of them have had asymmetric payoff, with one side carrying a larger consequence than the other. You decide principally based on fragility, not probability. Or to rephrase, you decide principally based on fragility, not so much on true-false. Let us discuss the idea of the insufficiency of true-false in decision-making in the real world, particularly when probabilities are involved. True or false are interpretations corresponding to high or low probabilities. Scientists have something called confidence level. A result obtained with a 95% confidence level means that there is no more than a 5% probability of the result being wrong. The idea, of course, is inapplicable, as it ignores the size of the effects, which, of course, makes things worse with extreme events. If I tell you that some result is true with 95% confidence level, you would be quite satisfied. But what if I told you that the plane was safe with 95% confidence level? Even 99% confidence level would not do, as a 1% probability of a crash would be quite a bit alarming. Today, commercial planes operate with less than 1 in several hundred thousand probabilities of crashing, and the ratio is improving, as we saw that every error leads to the improvement of overall safety. So, to repeat, the probability, hence true-false, does not work in the real world. It is the payoff that matters. You have taken probably a billion decisions in your life. How many times have you computed probabilities? Of course, you may do so in casinos, but not elsewhere. Conflation of events and exposure. This brings us again to the green lumber fallacy. A black swan event and how it affects you, its impact on your finances, emotions, the destruction it will cause, are not the same thing. And the problem is deeply ingrained in standard reactions. The predictor's reply when we point out their failures has typically been, we need better computation in order to predict the event better and figure out the probabilities, instead of the vastly more effective modify your exposure and learn to get out of trouble, something religions and traditional heuristics have been better at enforcing than naive and cosmetic science. Conclusion to Book 4. In addition to the medical empirics, this section has attempted to vindicate the unreasonable mavericks, engineers, freelance entrepreneurs, innovative artists, and anti-academic thinkers who have been reviled by history. Some of them had great courage, not just the courage to put forth their ideas, but the courage to accept to live in a world they knew they did not understand. And they enjoyed it. To conclude this section, note that doing is wiser than you are prone to believe, and more rational. What I did here is just debunk the lecturing birds how to fly epiphenomenon and the linear model, using, among other things, the simple mathematical properties of optionality, which does not require knowledge or intelligence, merely rationality in choice. Remember that there is no empirical evidence to support the statement that organized research, in the sense it is currently marketed, leads to the great things promised by universities. And the promoters of the Soviet Harvard idea do not use optionality or second-order effects. This absence of optionality in their accounts invalidates their views about the role of teleological science. They need to rewrite the history of technology. What will happen next? When I last met Alison Wolfe, we discussed this dire problem with education and illusions of academic contribution, with Ivy League universities becoming in the eyes of the new Asian and U.S. upper class a status luxury good. Harvard is like a Vuitton bag or a Cartier watch. It is a huge drag on the middle class parents who have been plowing an increased share of their savings into these institutions, transferring their money to administrators, real estate developers, professors, and other agents. In the United States, we have a buildup of student loans that automatically transfer to these rent extractors. In a way, it is no different from racketeering. One needs a decent university name to get ahead in life, but we know that collectively society doesn't appear to advance with organized education. She requested that I write to her my thoughts about the future of education, as I told her that I was optimistic on the subject. My answer? Bullshit is fragile. Which scam in history has lasted forever? I have an enormous faith in time and history as eventual debunkers of fragility. Education is an institution that has been growing without external stressors. Eventually, the thing will collapse. The next two books, 5 and 6, will deal with the notion that fragile things break predictably. Book 5 will show how to detect fragility in a more technical manner, and will present the mechanics behind the Philosopher's Stone. Book 6 is based on the idea that time is an eraser rather than a builder, and a good one at breaking the fragile, whether buildings or ideas. Book 5. The Nonlinear and the Nonlinear. Time for another autobiographical vignette. As Charles Darwin wrote in a historical section of his On the Origin of Species, presenting a sketch of the progress of opinion, I hope I may be excused for entering on these personal details, as I give them to show that I have not been hasty in coming to a decision. For it is not quite true that there is no exact word, concept, and application for anti-fragility. My colleagues and I had one without knowing it, and I had it for a long, very long time. So I have been thinking about the exact same problem most of my life, partly consciously, partly without being aware of it. Book 5 explores the journey and the idea that came with it. On the Importance of Attics. In the mid-1990s, I quietly deposited my necktie in the trash can at the corner of 45th Street and Park Avenue in New York. I decided to take a few years off and locked myself in the attic, trying to express what was coming out of my guts, trying to frame what I called hidden nonlinearities and their effects. What I had wasn't quite an idea, rather just a method, for the deeper central idea eluded me. But using this method, I produced close to a 600-page long discussion of managing nonlinear effects with graphs and tables. Recall from the prologue that nonlinearity means that the response is not a straight line. But I was going further and looking at the link with volatility, something that should be clear soon. And I went deep into the volatility of volatility and such higher-order effects. The book that came out of this solitary investigation in the attic, finally called Dynamic Hedging, was about the techniques to manage and handle complicated nonlinear derivative exposures. It was a technical document that was completely ab ovo from the egg, and as I was going, I knew in my guts that the point had vastly more import than the limited cases I was using in my profession. I knew that my profession was the perfect platform to start thinking about these issues, but I was too lazy and too conventional to venture beyond. That book remained by far my favorite work before this one, and I fondly remember the two harsh New York winters in the near-complete silence of the attic, with the luminous effect of the sun shining on the snow warming up both the room and the project. I thought of nothing else for years. I also learned something quite amusing from the episode. My book was mistakenly submitted to 4 referees, all 4 of them academic financial economists instead of quants, quantitative analysts who work in finance using mathematical models. The person who made the submissions wasn't quite aware of the difference. The 4 academics rejected my book, interestingly, for 4 sets of completely different reasons, with absolutely no intersection in their arguments. We practitioners and quants aren't too fazed by remarks on the part of academics. It would be like prostitutes listening to technical commentary by nuns. What struck me was that if I had been wrong, all of them would have provided the exact same reason for rejection. That's anti-fragility. Then, of course, as the publisher saw the mistake, the book was submitted to quantitative reviewers, and it saw the light of day. The Procrustean bed in life consists precisely in simplifying the nonlinear and making it linear, the simplification that distorts. Then my interest in the nonlinearity of exposures went away as I began to deal with other matters related to uncertainty, which seemed more intellectual and philosophical to me, like the nature of randomness, rather than how things react to random events. This may also have been due to the fact that I moved and no longer had that attic. But some events brought me back to a second phase of intense seclusion. After the crisis of the late 2000s, I went through an episode of hell owing to contact with the press. I was suddenly de-intellectualized, corrupted, extracted from my habitat, propelled into being a public commodity. I had not realized that it is hard for members of the media and the public to accept that the job of a scholar is to ignore insignificant current affairs, to write books, not emails, and not to give lectures dancing on a stage. That he has other things to do, like read in bed in the morning, write at a desk in front of a window, take long walks slowly, drink espressos mornings, chamomile tea afternoons, Lebanese wine evenings, and muscat wines after dinner. Take more long walks slowly, argue with friends and family members, but never in the morning, and read again in bed before sleeping. Not keep rewriting one's book and ideas for the benefit of strangers and members of the local chapter of Networking International who haven't read it. Then I opted out of public life. When I managed to retake control of my schedule and my brain, recovered from the injuries deep into my soul, learned to use email filters and auto-delete functions, and restarted my life, Lady Fortuna brought two ideas to me, making me feel stupid, for I realized I had had them inside me all along. Clearly, the tools of analysis of nonlinear effects are quite universal. The sad part is that until that day in my new life of solitary Walker cum chamomile drinker, when I looked at a porcelain cup, I had not realized that everything nonlinear around me could be subjected to the same techniques of detection as the ones that hit me in my previous episode of seclusion. What I found is described in the next two chapters. Chapter 18. Convexity, concavity, and convexity effects. Why size fragilizes. On the difference between a large stone and 1,000 pebbles. How to punish with a stone. I landed early, once. Why attics are always useful. On the great benefits of avoiding Heathrow, unless you have a guitar. I noticed, looking at the porcelain cup, that it did not like volatility, or variability, or action. It just wanted calm and to be left alone in the tranquility of the home study library. The realization that fragility was simply vulnerability to the volatility of the things that affect it was a huge personal embarrassment for me, since my specialty was the link between volatility and nonlinearity. I know, a very strange specialty. So let us start with the result. A simple rule to detect the fragile. A story present in the rabbinical literature, Midrash Tehillim, probably originating from earlier Near Eastern lore, says the following. A king, angry at his son, swore that he would crush him with a large stone. After he calmed down, he realized he was in trouble, as a king who breaks his oath is unfit to rule. His sage advisor came up with a solution. Have the stone cut into very small pebbles, and have the mischievous son pelted with them. The difference between 1,000 pebbles and a large stone of equivalent weight is a potent illustration of how fragility stems from nonlinear effects. Nonlinear. Once again, nonlinear means that the response is not straightforward and not a straight line. So if you double, say, the dose, you get a lot more or a lot less than double the effect. If I throw at someone's head a 10-pound stone, it will cause more than twice the harm of a 5-pound stone, more than five times the harm of a 1-pound stone, etc. It is simple. If you draw a line on a graph, with harm on the vertical axis and the size of stone on the horizontal axis, it will be curved, not a straight line. That is a refinement of asymmetry. Now, the very simple point, in fact, that allows for a detection of fragility. For the fragile, shocks bring higher harm as their intensity increases, up to a certain level. Let us generalize. Your car is fragile. If you drive it into the wall at 50 miles per hour, it would cause more damage than if you drove it into the same wall 10 times at 5 miles per hour. The harm at 50 miles per hour is more than 10 times the harm at 5 miles per hour. Other examples. Drinking 7 bottles of wine, Bordeaux, in one sitting, then purified water with lemon twist for the remaining 6 days is more harmful than drinking 1 bottle of wine a day for 7 days, spread out in 2 glasses per meal. Every additional glass of wine harms you more than the preceding one. Hence, your system is fragile to alcoholic consumption. Letting a porcelain cup drop on the floor from a height of 1 foot, about 30 centimeters, is worse than 12 times the damage from a drop from a height of 1 inch, 2.5 centimeters. Jumping from a height of 30 feet, 10 meters, brings more than 10 times the harm of jumping from a height of 3 feet, 1 meter. Actually, 30 feet seems to be the cutoff point for death from free fall. Note that this is a simple expansion of the foundational asymmetry we saw 2 chapters ago, as we used Seneca's thinking as a pretext to talk about nonlinearity. Asymmetry is necessarily nonlinearity. More harm than benefits. Simply, an increase in intensity brings more harm than a corresponding decrease offers benefits. Why is fragility nonlinear? Let me explain the central argument, why fragility is generally in the nonlinear and not in the linear. That was the intuition from the porcelain cup. The answer has to do with the structure of survival probabilities, conditional on something being unharmed or having survived. Then it is more harmed by a single rock than 1,000 pebbles, that is, by a single large, infrequent event than by the cumulative effect of smaller shocks. If for a human, jumping 1 millimeter, an impact of small force, caused an exact linear fraction of the damage of, say, jumping to the ground from 30 feet, then the person would already be dead from cumulative harm. Actually, a simple computation shows that he would have expired within hours from touching objects or pacing in his living room, given the multitude of such stressors and their total effect. The fragility that comes from linearity is immediately visible, so we rule it out because the object would be already broken. This leaves us with the following. What is fragile is something that is both unbroken and subjected to nonlinear effects, and extreme rare events, since impacts of large size or high speed are rarer than ones of small size and slow speed. Let me rephrase this idea in connection with black swans and extreme events. There are a lot more ordinary events than extreme events. In the financial markets, there are at least 10,000 times more events of 0.1% magnitude than events of 10% magnitude. There are close to 8,000 micro-earthquakes daily on planet Earth, that is, those below 2 on the Richter scale, about 3 million a year. These are totally harmless, and, with 3 million per year, you would need them to be so. But shocks of intensity 6 and higher on the scale make the newspapers. Take objects such as porcelain cups. They get a lot of hits, a million more hits of, say, 1/100th of a pound per square inch, to take an arbitrary measure, than hits of 100 pounds per square inch. Accordingly, we are necessarily immune to the cumulative effect of small deviations or shocks of very small magnitude, which implies that these affect us disproportionately less, that is, nonlinearly less, than larger ones. Let me re-express my previous rule. For the fragile, the cumulative effect of small shocks is smaller than the single effect of an equivalent single large shock. This leaves me with the principle that the fragile is what is hurt a lot more by extreme events than by a succession of intermediate ones. Finito. And there is no other way to be fragile. Now let us flip the argument and consider the antifragile. Antifragility, too, is grounded in nonlinearities, nonlinear responses. For the antifragile, shocks bring more benefits, equivalently less harm, as their intensity increases up to a point. A simple case, known heuristically by weightlifters. In the bodyguard emulating story in Chapter 2, I focused only on the maximum I could do. Lifting 100 pounds once brings more benefits than lifting 50 pounds twice, and certainly a lot more than lifting 1 pound 100 times. Benefits here are in weightlifter terms, strengthening the body, muscle mass, and bar fight looks rather than resistance and the ability to run a marathon. The second 50 pounds play a larger role, hence the nonlinear, that is, we will see, convexity effect. Every additional pound brings more benefits until one gets close to the limit, what weightlifters call failure. Actually, there are different muscle fibers, each one responding to different sets of conditions with varied asymmetries of responses. The so-called fast twitch fibers, the ones used to lift very heavy objects, are very anti-fragile, as they are convex to weight, and they die in the absence of intensity. For now, note the reach of this simple curve. It affects about just anything in sight, even medical error, government size, innovation, anything that touches uncertainty. And it helps put the plumbing behind the statements on size and concentration in Book 2. When to smile and when to frown. Nonlinearity comes in two kinds. Concave, curves inward, as in the case of the king and the stone, or its opposite, convex, curves outward. And of course, mixed, with concave and convex sections. The convex and the concave resemble a smile and a frown, respectively. I use the term convexity effect for both, in order to simplify the vocabulary, saying positive convexity effects and negative convexity effects. Why does asymmetry map to convexity or concavity? Simply, if for a given variation you have more upside than downside, and you draw the curve, it will be convex. The opposite for the concave. Graphic 5 in your PDF file shows the asymmetry re-expressed in terms of non-linearities. It also shows the magical effects of mathematics that allowed us to treat steak tartare, entrepreneurship, and financial risk in the same breath. The convex graph turns into concave when one simply puts a minus sign in front of it. For instance, Fat Tony had the exact opposite payoff than, say, a bank or financial institution in a certain transaction. He made a buck whenever they lost one, and vice versa. The profits and losses are mirror images of each other at the end of the day, except that one is the minus sign times the other. Graphic 5 also shows why the convex likes volatility. If you earn more than you lose from fluctuations, you want a lot of fluctuations. Why is the concave hurt by black swan events? Now the idea that has inhabited me all my life. I never realized it could show so clearly when put in graphical form. Graphic 6 in your PDF file illustrates the effects of harm and the unexpected. The more concave an exposure, the more harm from the unexpected, and disproportionately so. So very large deviations have a disproportionately larger and larger effect. Next, let us apply this very simple technique to the detection of fragility and position in the triad. Traffic in New York. Let us apply convexity effects to things around us. Traffic is highly nonlinear. When I take the day flight from New York to London, and I leave my residence around 5 in the morning, yes, I know, it takes me around 26 minutes to reach the British Air Terminal at JFK Airport. At that time, New York is empty, eerily non-New York. When I leave my place at 6 o'clock for the later flight, there is almost no difference in travel time, although traffic is a bit denser. One can add more and more cars on the highway with no or minimal impact on time spent in traffic. Then, a mystery. Increase the number of cars by 10% and watch the travel time jump by 50%. I'm using approximate numbers. Look at the convexity effect at work. The average number of cars on the road does not matter at all for traffic speed. If you have 90,000 cars for 1 hour, then 110,000 cars for another hour, traffic would be much slower than if you had 100,000 cars for 2 hours. Note that travel time is a negative, so I count it as a cost, like an expense, and a rise is a bad thing. So travel cost is fragile to the volatility of the number of cars on the highway. It does not depend so much on their average number. Every additional car increases travel time more than the previous one. This is a hint to a central problem of the world today, that of the misunderstanding of nonlinear response by those involved in creating efficiencies and optimization of systems. For instance, European airports and railroads are stretched, seeming overly efficient. They operate at close to maximal capacity, with minimal redundancies and idle capacity, hence acceptable costs. But a small increase in congestion, say 5% more planes in the sky, owing to a tiny backlog, can give rise to chaos in airports and cause scenes of unhappy travelers camping on floors, their only solace some bearded fellow playing French folk songs on his guitar. We can see applications of the point across economic domains. Central banks can print money. They print and print with no effect and claim the safety of such a measure. Then, unexpectedly, the printing causes a jump in inflation. Many economic results are completely canceled by convexity effects, and the happy news is that we know why. Alas, the tools and culture of policymakers are based on the overly linear, ignoring these hidden effects. They call it approximation. When you hear of a second-order effect, it means convexity is causing the failure of approximation to represent the real story. If I graph the response of traffic to cars on the road, the graph will curve inward, concave. Not a good thing. Someone call New York City officials. An apt illustration of how convexity effects affect an over-optimized system, along with misforecasting large deviations, is this simple story of an underestimation made by New York City officials of the effect of a line closure on traffic congestion. This error is remarkably general, a small modification with compounded results in a system that is extremely stretched, hence fragile. One Saturday evening in November 2011, I drove to New York City to meet the philosopher Paul Boghossian for dinner in the Village, typically a 40-minute trip. Ironically, I was meeting him to talk about my book, this book, and more particularly, my ideas on redundancy in systems. I have been advocating the injection of redundancy into people's lives and had been boasting to him and others that, since my New Year's resolution of 2007, I have never been late to anything, not even by a minute. Well, almost. Recall in Chapter 2 my advocacy of redundancies as an aggressive stance. Such personal discipline forces me to build buffers and, as I carry a notebook, it allowed me to write an entire book of aphorisms, not counting long visits to bookstores. Or I can sit in a cafe and read hate mail, with, of course, no stress, as I have no fear of being late. But the greatest benefit of such discipline is that it prevents me from cramming my day with appointments. Typically, appointments are neither useful nor pleasant. Actually, by another rule of personal discipline, I do not make appointments, other than lectures, except the very same morning, as a date on the calendar makes me feel like a prisoner, but that's another story. As I hit Midtown around 6 o'clock, traffic stopped, completely. By 8, I had moved hardly a few blocks, so even my redundancy buffer failed to let me keep the so far unbroken resolution. Then, after relearning to operate the noisy, cacophonic thing called the radio, I started figuring out what had happened. New York City had authorized a film company to use the 59th Street Bridge, blocking part of it, assuming that it would be no problem on a Saturday. And the small traffic problem turned into mayhem, owing to the multiplicative effects. What they felt would be at the worst a few minutes' delays was multiplied by two orders of magnitude. Minutes became hours. Simply, the authorities running New York City did not understand non-linearities. This is the central problem of efficiency. These types of errors compound, multiply, swell, with an effect that only goes in one direction, the wrong direction. Where more is different. Another intuitive way to look at convexity effects. Consider the scaling property. If you double the exposure to something, do you more than double the harm it will cause? If so, then this is a situation of fragility. Otherwise, you are robust. The point has been aptly expressed by P.W. Anderson in the title of his paper, More is Different. And what scientists involved in complexity call emerging properties is the nonlinear result of adding units, as the sum becomes increasingly different from the parts. Just look at how different the large stone is from the pebbles. The latter have the same weight and the same general shape, but that's about it. Likewise, we saw in Chapter 5 that a city is not a large village. A corporation is not a larger small business. We also saw how randomness changes in nature from mediocristan to extremistan, how a state is not a large village, and many alterations that come from size and speed. All these show nonlinearity in action. A balanced meal. Another example of missing the hidden dimension, that is, variability. We are currently told by the Soviet Harvard U.S. health authorities to eat set quantities of nutrients, total calories, protein, vitamins, etc., every day, in some recommended amounts of each. Every food item has a percentage daily allowance. Aside from the total lack of empirical rigor in the way these recommendations are currently derived, more on that in the medical chapters, there is another sloppiness in the edict, an insistence in the discourse on the regularity. Those recommending the nutritional policies fail to understand that steadily getting your calories and nutrients throughout the day, with balanced composition and metronomic regularity, does not necessarily have the same effect as consuming them unevenly or randomly, say, by having a lot of proteins one day, fasting completely another, feasting the third, etc. This is a denial of hormesis, the slight stressor of episodic deprivation. For a long time, nobody even bothered to try to figure out whether variability in distribution, the second-order effect, mattered as much as long-term composition. Now research is starting to catch up to such a very, very simple point. It turns out that the effect of variability in food sources and the non-linearity in the physiological response is central to biological systems. Consuming no protein at all on Monday and catching up on Wednesday seemingly causes a different, better physiological response, possibly because the deprivation, as a stressor, activates some pathways that facilitate the subsequent absorption of the nutrients, or something similar. And, until a few recent and disconnected empirical studies, this convexity effect has been totally missed by science, though not by religions, ancestral heuristics, and traditions. And if scientists get some convexity effects, as we said about domain dependence, doctors, just like weightlifters, understand here and there non-linearities in dose response, the notion of convexity effects itself appears to be completely missing from their language and methods. Run, don't walk. Another illustration, this time a situation that benefits from variation, positive convexity effects. Take two brothers, Castor and Polydeuces, who need to travel a mile. Castor walks the mile at a leisurely pace and arrives at the destination in 20 minutes. Polydeuces spends 14 minutes playing with his handheld device, getting updates on the gossip, then runs the same mile in 6 minutes, arriving at the same time as Castor. So both persons have covered the exact same distance in exactly the same time, same average. Castor, who walked all the way, presumably will not get the same health benefits and gains in strength as Polydeuces, who sprinted. Health benefits are convex to speed, up to a point, of course. The very idea of exercise is to gain from anti-fragility to workout stressors. As we saw, all kinds of exercise are just exploitations of convexity effects. Small may be ugly. It is certainly less fragile. We often hear the expression, small is beautiful. It is potent and appealing. Many ideas have been offered in its support, almost all of them anecdotal, romantic, or existential. Let us present it within our approach of fragility equals concavity equals dislike of randomness, and see how we can measure such an effect. How to be squeezed. A squeeze occurs when people have no choice but to do something, and do it right away, regardless of the costs. Your other half is to defend a doctoral thesis in the history of German dance, and you need to fly to Marburg to be present at such an important moment, meet the parents, and get formally engaged. You live in New York and manage to buy an economy ticket to Frankfurt for $400, and you are excited about how cheap it is. But you need to go through London. Upon getting to New York's Kennedy Airport, you are apprised by the airline agent that the flights to London are canceled. Sorry, delays due to backlog, due to weather problems, that type of thing. Something about Heathrow's fragility. You can get a last-minute flight to Frankfurt, but now you need to pay $4,000, close to 10 times the price, and hurry as there are very few seats left. You fume, shout, curse, blame yourself, your upbringing, and parents who taught you to save, then shell out the $4,000. That's a squeeze. Squeezes are exacerbated by size. When one is large, one becomes vulnerable to some errors, particularly horrendous squeezes. The squeezes become non-linearly costlier as size increases. To see how size becomes a handicap, consider the reasons one should not own an elephant as a pet, regardless of what emotional attachment you may have to the animal. Say you can afford an elephant as part of your post-promotion household budget and have one delivered to your backyard. Should there be a water shortage, hence a squeeze, since you have no choice but to shell out the money for water, you would have to pay a higher and higher price for each additional gallon of water. That's fragility, right there, a negative convexity effect coming from getting too big. The unexpected cost, as a percentage of the total, would be monstrous. Owning, say, a cat or a dog would not bring about such high unexpected additional costs at times of squeeze. The overruns taken as a percentage of the total costs would be very low. In spite of what is studied in business schools concerning economies of scale, size hurts you at times of stress. It is not a good idea to be large during difficult times. Some economists have been wondering why mergers of corporations do not appear to play out. The combined unit is now much larger, hence more powerful, and according to the theories of economies of scale, it should be more efficient. But the numbers show, at best, no gain from such increase in size. That was already true in 1978, when Richard Roll voiced the hubris hypothesis, finding it irrational for companies to engage in mergers given their poor historical record. Recent data, more than three decades later, still confirm both the poor record of mergers and the same hubris as managers seem to ignore the bad economic aspect of the transaction. There appears to be something about size that is harmful to corporations. As with the idea of having elephants as pets, squeezes are much, much more expensive relative to size for large corporations. The gains from size are visible, but the risks are hidden, and some concealed risks seem to bring frailties into the companies. Large animals, such as elephants, boa constrictors, mammoths, and other animals of size, tend to become rapidly extinct. Aside from the squeeze when resources are tight, there are mechanical considerations. Large animals are more fragile to shocks than small ones. Again, stone and pebbles. Jared Diamond, always ahead of others, figured out such vulnerability in a paper called Why Cats Have Nine Lives. If you throw a cat or a mouse from an elevation of several times their height, they will typically manage to survive. Elephants, by comparison, break limbs very easily. Curvial and microcurvial. Let us look at a case study from Vulgar Finance, a field in which participants are very good at making mistakes. On January 21, 2008, the Parisian bank Société Générale rushed to sell in the market close to $70 billion worth of stocks, a very large amount for any single fire sale. Markets were not very active, called thin, as it was Martin Luther King Day in the United States, and markets worldwide dropped precipitously, close to 10%, costing the company close to $6 billion in losses just from their fire sale. The entire point of the squeeze is that they couldn't wait, and they had no option but to turn a sale into a fire sale. For they had, over the weekend, uncovered a fraud. Jerome Curviel, a rogue back-office employee, was playing with humongous sums in the market and hiding these exposures from the main computer system. They had no choice but to sell immediately these stocks they didn't know they owned. Now, to see the effect of fragility from size, look at losses as a function of quantity sold. A fire sale of $70 billion worth of stocks leads to a loss of $6 billion. But a fire sale a tenth of the size, $7 billion, would result in no loss at all, as markets would absorb the quantities without panic, maybe without even noticing. So this tells us that if, instead of having one very large bank with Monsieur Curviel as a rogue trader, we had 10 smaller banks, each with a proportional Monsieur Micro Curviel, and each conducted his rogue trading independently and at random times, the total losses for the 10 banks would be close to nothing. About a few weeks before the Kerviel episode, a French business school hired me to present to the board of executives of the Société Générale meeting in Prague my ideas of black swan risks. In the eyes of the bankers, I was like a Jesuit preacher visiting Mecca in the middle of the annual Hajj. Their quants and risk people hated me with passion, and I regretted not having insisted on speaking in Arabic, given that they had simultaneous translation. My talk was about pseudo-risk techniques a la Triffat, methods commonly used, as I said, to measure and predict events that have never worked before, and how we needed to focus on fragility and barbells. During the talk, I was heckled relentlessly by Kerviel's boss and his colleague, the head of risk management. After my talk, everyone ignored me as if I were a Martian, with a who-brought-this-guy-here awkward situation. I had been selected by the school, not the bank. The only person who was nice to me was the chairman, as he mistook me for someone else and had no clue about what I was discussing. So the reader can imagine my state of mind when, shortly after my return to New York, the Kerviel trading scandal broke. It was also tantalizing that I had to keep my mouth shut, which I did, except for a few slips, for legal reasons. Clearly, the post-mortem analyses were plainly mistaken, attributing the problem to bad controls by the bad capitalistic system and lack of vigilance on the part of the bank. It was not, nor was it greed, as we commonly assume. The problem is primarily size and the fragility that comes from size. Always keep in mind the difference between a stone and its weight in pebbles. The Kerviel story is illustrative, so we can generalize and look at evidence across domains. In project management, Bent Flupiao has shown firm evidence that an increase in the size of projects maps to poor outcomes and higher costs of delays as a proportion of the total budget. But there is a nuance. It is the size per segment of the project that matters, not the entire project. Some projects can be divided into pieces, not others. Bridge and tunnel projects involve monolithic planning, as these cannot be broken up into small portions. Their percentage costs overruns increase markedly with size. Same with dams. For roads, built by small segments, there is no serious size effect, as the project managers incur only small errors and can adapt to them. Small segments go one small error at a time, with no serious role for squeezes. Another aspect of size. Large corporations also end up endangering neighborhoods. I've used the following argument against large superstore chains in spite of the advertised benefits. A large super megastore wanted to acquire an entire neighborhood near where I live, causing uproar owing to the change it would bring to the character of the neighborhood. The argument in favor was the revitalization of the area, that type of story. I fought the proposal on the following grounds. Should the company go bust, and the statistical elephant in the room is that it eventually will, we would end up with a massive war zone. This is the type of argument the British advisors Rohan Silva and Steve Hilton have used in favor of small merchants, along the poetic small is beautiful. It is completely wrong to use the calculus of benefits without including the probability of failure. How to exit a movie theater. Another example of the costs of a squeeze. Imagine how people exit a movie theater. Someone shouts, "Fire!" and you have a dozen persons squashed to death. So we have a fragility of the theater to size, stemming from the fact that every additional person exiting brings more and more trauma. Such disproportional harm is a negative convexity effect. 1,000 people exiting, or trying to exit, in 1 minute is not the same as the same number exiting in half an hour. Someone unfamiliar with the business who naively optimizes the size of the place, Heathrow Airport, for example, might miss the idea that smooth functioning at regular times is different from the rough functioning at times of stress. It so happens that contemporary economic optimized life causes us to build larger and larger theaters, but with the exact same door. They no longer make this mistake too often while building cinemas, movie theaters, and stadiums, but we tend to make the mistake in other domains, such as, for instance, natural resources and food supplies. Just consider that the price of wheat more than tripled in the years 2004 to 2007 in response to a small increase in net demand, around 1%. Bottlenecks are the mothers of all squeezes. Projects and prediction. Why planes don't arrive early. Let us start as usual with a transportation problem and generalize to other areas. Travelers typically do not like uncertainty, especially when they are on a set schedule. Why? There is a one-way effect. I've taken the very same London-New York flight most of my life. The flight takes about 7 hours, the equivalent of a short book plus a brief polite chat with a neighbor and a meal with port wine, Stilton cheese, and crackers. I recall a few instances in which I arrived early, about 20 minutes, no more. But there have been instances in which I got there more than 2 or 3 hours late, and in at least one instance it has taken me more than 2 days to reach my destination. Because travel time cannot be really negative, uncertainty tends to cause delays, making arrival time increase, almost never decrease. Or it makes arrival time decrease by just minutes, but increase by hours, an obvious asymmetry. Anything unexpected, any shock, any volatility, is much more likely to extend the total flying time. This also explains the irreversibility of time in a way, if you consider the passage of time as an increase in disorder. Let us now apply this concept to projects. Just as when you add uncertainty to a flight, the planes tend to land later, not earlier, and these laws of physics are so universal that they even work in Russia. When you add uncertainty to projects, they tend to cost more and take longer to complete. This applies to many, in fact, almost all, projects. The interpretation I had in the past was that a psychological bias, the underestimation of the random structure of the world, was the cause behind such underestimations. Projects take longer than planned because the estimates are too optimistic. We have evidence of such bias, called overconfidence. Decision scientists and business psychologists have theorized something called the planning fallacy, in which they try to explain the fact that projects take longer, rarely less time, using psychological factors. But the puzzle was that such underestimation did not seem to exist in the past century or so, though we were dealing with the very same humans, endowed with the same biases. Many large-scale projects a century and a half ago were completed on time. Many of the tall buildings and monuments we see today are not just more elegant than modernistic structures, but were completed within and often ahead of schedule. These include not just the Empire State Building, still standing in New York, but the London Crystal Palace, erected for the Great Exhibition of 1851, the hallmark of the Victorian reign, based on the inventive ideas of a gardener. The palace, which housed the exhibition, went from concept to grand opening in just 9 months. The building took the form of a massive glass house, 1,848 feet long by 454 feet wide. It was constructed from cast iron frame components and glass, made almost exclusively in Birmingham and Smethwick. The obvious is usually missed here. The Crystal Palace project did not use computers, and the parts were built not far from the source, with a small number of businesses involved in the supply chain. Further, there were no business schools at the time to teach something called project management and increase overconfidence. There were no consulting firms. The agency problem, which we defined as the divergence between the interest of the agent and that of his client, was not significant. In other words, it was a much more linear economy, less complex than today. And we have more nonlinearities, asymmetries, convexities, in today's world. Black swan effects are necessarily increasing as a result of complexity, interdependence between parts, globalization, and the beastly thing called efficiency that makes people now sail too close to the wind. Add to that consultants and business schools. One problem somewhere can halt the entire project, so the projects tend to get as weak as the weakest link in their chain, an acute negative convexity effect. The world is getting less and less predictable, and we rely more and more on technologies that have errors and interactions that are harder to estimate, let alone predict. And the information economy is the culprit. Bent Flupiel, the one of bridge and road projects mentioned earlier in this chapter, showed another result. The problem of cost overruns and delays is much more acute in the presence of information technologies, IT, as computer projects cause a large share of these cost overruns, and it is better to focus on these principally. But even outside of these IT-heavy projects, we tend to have very severe delays. But the logic is simple. Again, negative convexity effects are the main culprit, a direct and visible cause. There is an asymmetry in the way errors hit you, the same as with travel. No psychologist who has discussed the planning fallacy has realized that, at the core, it is not essentially a psychological problem, not an issue with human errors. It is inherent to the nonlinear structure of the projects. Just as time cannot be negative, a 3-month project cannot be completed in zero or negative time. So, on a timeline going left to right, errors add to the right end, not the left end of it. If uncertainty were linear, we would observe some projects completed extremely early, just as we would arrive sometimes very early, sometimes very late. But that is not the case. Wars, deficits, and deficits. The Great War was estimated to last only a few months. By the time it was over, it had gotten France and Britain heavily in debt. They incurred at least 10 times what they thought their financial costs would be, aside from all the horrors, suffering, and destruction. The same, of course, for the Second War, which added to the UK debt, causing it to become heavily indebted, mostly to the United States. In the United States, the prime example remains the Iraq War, expected by George W. Bush and his friends to cost $30 to $60 billion, which so far, taking into account all the indirect costs, may have swelled to more than $2 trillion. Indirect costs multiply, causing chains, explosive chains of interactions, all going in the same direction of more costs, not less. Complexity plus asymmetry, plus such types as George W. Bush, once again, lead to explosive errors. The larger the military, the disproportionately larger the cost overruns. But wars, with more than 20-fold errors, are only illustrative of the way governments underestimate explosive nonlinearities, convexity effects, and why they should not be trusted with finances or any large-scale decisions. Indeed, governments do not need wars at all to get us in trouble with deficits. The underestimation of the costs of their projects is chronic for the very same reason 98% of contemporary projects have overruns. They just end up spending more than they tell us. This has led me to install a governmental golden rule: no borrowing allowed, forced fiscal balance. Where the efficient is not efficient. We can easily see the costs of fragility swelling in front of us, visible to the naked eye. Global disaster costs are today more than 3 times what they were in the 1980s, adjusting for inflation. The effect, noted a while ago by the visionary researcher on extreme events Daniel Zeidenweber, seems to be accelerating. The economy can get more and more efficient, but fragility is causing the costs of errors to be higher. The stock exchanges have converted from open outcry, where wild traders face each other, yelling and screaming as in a souk, then go drink together. Traders were replaced by computers for very small visible benefits and massively large risks. While errors made by traders are confined and distributed, those made by computerized systems go wild. In August 2010, a computer error made the entire market crash, the flash crash. In August 2012, as this manuscript was heading to the printer, the Knight Capital Group had its computer system go wild and cause $10 million of losses a minute, losing $480 million. And naive cost-benefit analyses can be a bit harmful, an effect that of course swells with size. For instance, the French have in the past focused on nuclear energy as it seemed clean and cheap and optimal on a computer screen. Then, after the wake-up call of the Fukushima disaster of 2011, they realized that they needed additional safety features and scrambled to add them at any cost. In a way, this is similar to the squeeze I mentioned earlier. They are forced to invest, regardless of price. Such additional expense was not part of the initial cost-benefit analysis that went into the initial decision and looked good on a computer screen. So when deciding on one source of fuel against another, or similar comparisons, we do not realize that model error may hit one side more than the other. Pollution and harm to the planet. From this, we can generate a simple ecological policy. We know that fossil fuels are harmful in a non-linear way. The harm is necessarily concave. If a little bit of it is devoid of harm, a lot can cause climatic disturbances. While on epistemological grounds, because of opacity, we do not need to believe in anthropogenic climate change, caused by humans, in order to be ecologically conservative, we can put these convexity effects to use in producing a risk management rule for pollution. Simply, just as with size, split your sources of pollution among many natural sources. The harm from polluting with 10 different sources is smaller than the equivalent pollution from a single source. Volatility and uncertainty are equivalent, as we saw with the table of the disorder family. Accordingly, note that the fragile is harmed by an increase in uncertainty. Let's look at nature-like ancestral mechanisms for regulating the concentration effects. We contemporary humans go to the stores to purchase the same items, say tuna, coffee or tea, rice, mozzarella, Cabernet wine, olive oil, and other items that appear to us as not easily substitutable. Because of sticky contemporary habits, cultural contagion, and the rigidity of factories, we are led to the excessive use of specific products. This concentration is harmful. Extreme consumption of, say, tuna can hurt other animals, mess with the ecosystem, and lead species to extinction. And not only does the harm scale non-linearly, but the shortages lead to disproportional rise in prices. Ancestral humans did it differently. Jennifer Dunn, a complexity researcher who studies hunter-gatherers, examined evidence about the behavior of the Aleuts, a North American native tribe, for which we have ample data covering 5 millennia. They exhibit a remarkable lack of concentration in their predatorial behavior, with a strategy of prey switching. They were not as sticky and rigid as us in their habits. Whenever they got low on a resource, they switched to another one, as if to preserve the ecosystem. So they understood convexity effects, or rather, their habits did. Note that globalization has had the effect of making contagions planetary, as if the entire world became a huge room with narrow exits and people rushing to the same doors with accelerated harm. Just as about every child reads Harry Potter and joins, for now, Facebook, people, when they get rich, are starting to engage in the same activities and buy the same items. They drink Cabernet wine, hope to visit Venice and Florence, dream of buying a second home in the south of France, etc. Tourist locations are becoming unbearable. Just go to Venice next July. The non-linearity of wealth. We can certainly attribute the fragilizing effect of contemporary globalization to complexity, and how connectivity and cultural contagions make gyrations in economic variables much more severe, the classic switch to extremistan. But there is another effect, wealth. Wealth means more, and because of nonlinear scaling, more is different. We are prone to make more severe errors because we are simply wealthier. Just as projects of $100 million are more unpredictable and more likely to incur overruns than $5 million ones, simply by being richer, the world is troubled with additional unpredictability and fragility. This comes with growth, at a country level, this highly dreamed of GDP growth. Even at an individual level, wealth means more headaches. We may need to work harder at mitigating the complications arising from wealth than we do at acquiring it. Conclusion. To conclude this chapter, fragility in any domain, from a porcelain cup to an organism, to a political system, to the size of a firm, or to delays in airports, resides in the nonlinear. Further, discovery can be seen as anti-deficit. Think of the exact opposite of airplane delays or project overruns, something that benefits from uncertainty. And discovery presents the mirror image of what we saw as fragile, randomness-hating situations. Chapter 19. The Philosopher's Stone. Deeper into convexity. How Fannie Mae went bust. Nonlinearity. The heuristic to detect fragility and antifragility. Convexity biases, Jensen's inequality, and their impact on ignorance. The Philosopher's Stone and its inverse. They tell you when they are going bust. Gold is sometimes a special variety of lead. And now, listener, after the Herculean effort I put into making the ideas of the last few chapters clearer to you, my turn to take it easy and express things technically, sort of. Accordingly, this chapter, a deepening of the ideas of the previous ones, will be denser and should be skipped by the enlightened listener. How to detect who will go bust. Let us examine a method to detect fragility, the inverse philosopher's stone. We can illustrate it with the story of the giant government-sponsored lending firm called Fannie Mae, a corporation that collapsed, leaving the United States taxpayer with hundreds of billions of dollars of losses, and alas, still counting. One day in 2003, Alex Berenson, a New York Times journalist, came into my office with the secret risk reports of Fannie Mae, given to him by a defector. It was the kind of report getting into the guts of the methodology for risk calculation that only an insider can see. Fannie Mae made its own risk calculations and disclosed what it wanted to whomever it wanted, the public or someone else. But only a defector could show us the guts to see how the risk was calculated. We looked at the report. Simply, a move upward in an economic variable led to massive losses, a move downward in the opposite direction to small profits. Further moves upward led to even larger additional losses, and further moves downward to even smaller profits. Acceleration of harm was obvious. In fact, it was monstrous. So we immediately saw that their blow-up was inevitable. Their exposures were severely concave, similar to the traffic example earlier. Losses that accelerate as one deviates economic variables. I did not even need to understand which one, as fragility to one variable of this magnitude implies fragility to all other parameters. I worked with my emotions, not my brain, and I had a pang before even understanding what numbers I had been looking at. It was the mother of all fragilities, and, thanks to Berenson, the New York Times presented my concern. A smear campaign ensued, but nothing too notable. For I had in the meantime called a few key people charlatans, and they were not too excited about it. The key is that the nonlinear is vastly more affected by extreme events, and nobody was interested in extreme events since they had a mental block against them. I kept telling anyone who would listen to me, including random taxi drivers, well, almost, that the company Fannie Mae was sitting on a barrel of dynamite. Of course, blow-ups don't happen every day, just as poorly built bridges don't collapse immediately. And people kept saying that my opinion was wrong and unfounded, using some argument that the stock was going up or something even more circular. I also inferred that other institutions, almost all banks, were in the same situation. After checking similar institutions and seeing that the problem was general, I realized that a total collapse of the banking system was a certainty. I was so certain I could not see straight and went back to the markets to get my revenge against the turkeys. As in the scene from The Godfather 3, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. Things happened as if they were planned by destiny. Fannie Mae went bust, along with other banks. It just took a bit longer than expected. No big deal. The stupid part of the story is that I had not seen the link between financial and general fragility. Nor did I use the term fragility. Maybe I didn't look at too many porcelain cups. However, thanks to the episode of the attic, I had a measure for fragility, hence anti-fragility. It all boils down to the following. figuring out if our miscalculations or misforecasts are on balance more harmful than they are beneficial, and how accelerating the damage is. Exactly as in the story of the king, in which the damage from a 10-kilogram stone is more than twice the damage from a 5-kilogram one. Such accelerating damage means that a large stone would eventually kill the person. Likewise, a large market deviation would eventually kill the company. Once I figured out that fragility was directly from nonlinearity and convexity effects, and that convexity was measurable, I got all excited. The technique, detecting acceleration of harm, applies to anything that entails decision-making under uncertainty and risk management. While it was the most interesting in medicine and technology, the immediate demand was in economics. So I suggested to the International Monetary Fund a measure of fragility to substitute for their measures of risk that they knew didn't work. Most people in the risk business had been frustrated by the poor, rather the random, performance of their models. But they didn't like my earlier stance, don't use any model. They wanted something. And a risk measure was there. The method does not require a good model for risk measurement. Take a ruler. You know it is wrong. It will not be able to measure the height of the child, but it can certainly tell you if he is growing. In fact, the error you get about the rate of growth of the child is much, much smaller than the error you would get measuring his height. The same with a scale. No matter how defective, it will almost always be able to tell you if you are gaining weight, so stop blaming it. Convexity is about acceleration. The remarkable thing about measuring convexity effects to detect model errors is that even if the model used for the computation is wrong, it can tell you if an entity is fragile and by how much it is fragile. As with the defective scale, we are only looking for second-order effects. So here is something to use. The technique, a simple heuristic called the fragility and anti-fragility detection heuristic, works as follows. Let's say you want to check whether a town is over-optimized. Say you measure that when traffic increases by 10,000 cars, travel time grows by 10 minutes. But if traffic increases by 10,000 more cars, travel time now extends by an extra 30 minutes. Such acceleration of traffic time shows that traffic is fragile and you have too many cars and need to reduce traffic until the acceleration becomes mild. Acceleration, I repeat, is acute concavity, or negative convexity effect. Likewise, government deficits are particularly concave to changes in economic conditions. Every additional deviation in, say, the unemployment rate, particularly when the government has debt, makes deficits incrementally worse. And financial leverage for a company has the same effect. You need to borrow more and more to get the same effect, just as in a Ponzi scheme. The same with operational leverage on the part of a fragile company. Should sales increase 10%, then profits would increase less than they would decrease should sales drop 10%. That was, in a way, the technique I used intuitively to declare that the highly respected firm Fannie Mae was on its way to the cemetery, and it was easy to produce a rule of thumb out of it. Now, with the IMF, we had a simple measure with a stamp. It looked simple, too simple. So the initial reaction from experts was that it was trivial, said by people who visibly never detected these risks before. Academics and quantitative analysts scorn what they can understand too easily and get ticked off by what they did not think of themselves. According to the wonderful principle that one should use people's stupidity to have fun, I invited my friend Raphael Duadi to collaborate in expressing this simple idea using the most opaque mathematical derivations with incomprehensible theorems that would take half a day for a professional to understand. Raphael, Bruno De Pier, and I have been involved in an almost 2-decades-long continuous conversation on how everything entailing risk, everything, can be seen with a lot more rigor and clarity from the vantage point of an option professional. Raphael and I managed to prove the link between nonlinearity, dislike of volatility, and fragility. Remarkably, as has been shown, if you can say something straightforward in a complicated manner with complex theorems, even if there is no large gain in rigor from these complicated equations, people take the idea very seriously. We got nothing but positive reactions, and we were now told that this simple detection heuristic was intelligence by the same people who had found it trivial. The only problem is that mathematics is addictive. The idea of positive and negative model error. Now, what I believe is my true specialty, error in models. When I was in the transaction business, I used to make plenty of errors of execution. You buy 1,000 units, and in fact, you discover the next day that you bought 2,000. If the price went up in the meantime, you had a handsome profit. Otherwise, you had a large loss. So these errors are in the long run neutral in effect, since they can affect you both ways. They increase the variance, but they don't affect your business too much. There is no one-sidedness to them. And these errors can be kept under control thanks to size limits. You make a lot of small transactions, so errors remain small. And at year-end, typically, the errors wash out, as they say. But that is not the case with most things we build, and with errors related to things that are fragile in the presence of negative convexity effects. This class of errors has a one-way outcome, that is, negative, and tends to make planes land later, not earlier. Wars tend to get worse, not better. As we saw with traffic, variations, now called disturbances, tend to increase travel time from South Kensington to Piccadilly Circus, never shorten it. Some things, like traffic, do rarely experience the equivalent of positive disturbances. This one-sidedness brings both underestimation of randomness and underestimation of harm, since one is more exposed to harm than benefit from error. If in the long run we get as much variation in the source of randomness one way as the other, the harm would severely outweigh the benefits. So, and this is the key to the triad, we can classify things by three simple distinctions. Things that, in the long run, like disturbances or errors, things that are neutral to them, and those that dislike them. By now we have seen that evolution likes disturbances. We saw that discovery likes disturbances. Some forecasts are hurt by uncertainty, and, like travel time, one needs a buffer. Airlines figured out how to do it, but not governments, when they estimate deficits. This method is very general. I even used it with Fukushima-style computations and realized how fragile their computation of small probabilities was. In fact, all small probabilities tend to be very fragile to errors, as a small change in the assumptions can make the probability rise dramatically, from 1 per million to 1 per 100. Indeed, a 10,000-fold underestimation. Finally, this method can show us where the math and economic models is bogus, which models are fragile and which ones are not. Simply do a small change in the assumptions and look at how large the effect, and if there is acceleration of such effect. Acceleration implies, as with Fannie Mae, that someone relying on the model blows up from black swan effects. Molto facile. What I can say for now is that much of what is taught in economics that has an equation, as well as econometrics, should be immediately ditched, which explains why economics is largely a charlatanic profession. Fragilistas, semper fragilisti. How to lose a grandmother. Next, I will explain the following effect of nonlinearity, conditions under which the average, the first-order effect, does not matter, as a first step before getting into the workings of the Philosopher's Stone. As the saying goes, do not cross a river if it is on average 4 feet deep. You have just been informed that your grandmother will spend the next 2 hours at the very desirable average temperature of 70 degrees Fahrenheit, about 21 degrees Celsius. Excellent, you think, since 70 degrees is the optimal temperature for grandmothers. Since you went to business school, you are a big-picture type of person and are satisfied with the summary information. But there is a second piece of data. Your grandmother, it turns out, will spend the first hour at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, around minus 18 Celsius, and the second hour at 140 degrees, around 60 degrees Celsius, for an average of the very desirable Mediterranean-style 70 degrees, 21 degrees Celsius. So it looks as though you will most certainly end up with no grandmother, a funeral, and possibly an inheritance. Clearly, temperature changes become more and more harmful as they deviate from 70 degrees. As you see, the second piece of information, the variability, turned out to be more important than the first. The notion of average is of no significance when one is fragile to variations. The dispersion and possible thermal outcomes here matters much more. Your grandmother is fragile to variations of temperature, to the volatility of the weather. Let us call that second piece of information the second-order effect, or more precisely, the convexity effect. Here, consider that, as much as a good simplification the notion of average can be, it can also be a Procrustean bed. The information that the average temperature is 70 degrees Fahrenheit does not simplify the situation for your grandmother. It is information squeezed into a Procrustean bed, and these are necessarily committed by scientific modelers, since a model is by its very nature a simplification. You just don't want the simplification to distort the situation to the point of being harmful. I can graph the fragility of the health of the grandmother to variations. If I plot health on the vertical axis and temperature on the horizontal one, I see a shape that curves inward, a concave shape or negative convexity effect. If the grandmother's response was linear, no curve, a straight line, then the harm of temperature below 70 degrees would be offset by the benefits of temperature above it. And the fact is that the health of the grandmother has to be capped at a maximum, otherwise she would keep improving. Take this for now as we rapidly move to the more general attributes. In the case of the grandmother's health response to temperature, A, there is non-linearity. The response is not a straight line, not linear. B, it curves inward, too much so. And finally, C, the more non-linear the response, the less relevant the average, and the more relevant the stability around such average. Now the Philosopher's Stone. Much of medieval thinking went into finding the Philosopher's Stone. It is always good to be reminded that chemistry is the child of alchemy, much of which consisted of looking into the chemical powers of substances. The main efforts went into creating value by transforming metals into gold by the method of transmutation. The necessary substance was called the Philosopher's Stone, lapis philosophorum. Many people fell for it, a list that includes such scholars as Albertus Magnus, Isaac Newton, and Roger Bacon, and great thinkers who were not quite scholars, such as Paracelsus. It is a matter of no small import that the operation of transmutation was called the magnus opus, the greatest work. I truly believe that the operation I will discuss, based on some properties of optionality, is about as close as we can get to the Philosopher's Stone. The following note would allow us to understand, A, the severity of the problem of conflation, mistaking the price of oil for geopolitics, or mistaking a profitable bet for good forecasting, not convexity of payoff and optionality. B, why anything with optionality has a long-term advantage, and how to measure it. C, the merger of the two points above, conflation and optionality. Recall from our traffic example in Chapter 18 that 90,000 cars for an hour, then 110,000 cars for the next one, for an average of 100,000, and traffic will be horrendous. On the other hand, assume we have 100,000 cars for 2 hours, and traffic will be smooth and time in traffic short. The number of cars is the something, a variable. Traffic time is the function of something. The behavior of the function is such that it is, as we said, not the same thing. We can see here that the function of something becomes different from the something under nonlinearities. A, the more nonlinear, the more the function of something divorces itself from the something. If traffic were linear, then there would be no difference in traffic time between the two following situations. 90,000, then 110,000 cars on the one hand, or 100,000 cars on the other. B, the more volatile the something, the more uncertainty, the more the function divorces itself from the something. Let us consider the average number of cars again. The function, travel time, depends more on the volatility around the average. Things degrade if there is evenness of distribution. For the same average, you prefer to have 100,000 cars for both time periods. 80,000 then 120,000 would be even worse than 90,000 and 110,000. C. If the function is convex, antifragile, then the average of the function of something is going to be higher than the function of the average of something. This is the philosopher's stone, and the reverse when the function is concave, fragile. As an example, assume that the function under question is the squaring function, multiply a number by itself. This is a convex function. Take a conventional die, six sides, and consider a payoff equal to the number it lands on. That is, you get paid a number equivalent to what the die shows, 1 if it lands on 1, 2 if it lands on 2, up to 6 if it lands on 6. The square of the expected average payoff is then the quantity of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 divided by 6 squared equals 3.5 squared, here 12.25. So the function of the average equals 12.25. But the average of the function is as follows. Take the square of every payoff, 1 squared plus 2 squared plus 3 squared plus 4 squared plus 5 squared plus 6 squared, divided by 6, that is, the average square payoff, and you can see that the average of the function equals 15.67. So, since squaring is a convex function, the average of the square payoff is higher than the square of the average payoff. The difference here between 15.67 and 12.25 is what I call the hidden benefit of antifragility. Here, a 28% edge. This is the convexity bias, the philosopher's stone. The conflation problem, mistaking a property of a function of something for the function of the property of something, leads to severe misunderstanding of the process. Someone with a linear payoff needs to be right more than 50% of the time. Someone with a convex payoff, much less. The hidden benefit of antifragility is that you can guess worse than random and still end up outperforming. Here lies the power of optionality. Your function of something is very convex, so you can be wrong and still do fine. The more uncertainty, the better. This explains my statement that you can be dumb and anti-fragile and still do very well. This convexity bias comes from a mathematical property called Jensen's inequality. This is what the common discourse on innovation is missing. If you ignore the convexity bias, you are missing a chunk of what makes the nonlinear world go round. And it is a fact that such an idea is missing from the discourse. Sorry. How to transform gold into mud, the inverse philosopher's stone. Let us take the same example as before, using as the function the square root, the exact inverse of squaring, which is concave, but much less concave than the square function is convex. The square of the expected average payoff is then the square root of the quantity of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 divided by 6 equals the square root of 3.5, here 1.87. The function of the average equals 1.87. But the average of the function is as follows. Take the square root of every payoff, the quantity of the square root of 1 plus the square root of 2 plus the square root of 3 plus the square root of 4 plus the square root of 5 plus the square root of 6 divided by 6, that is, the average square root payoff, and you can see that the average of the function equals 1.80. The difference is called the negative convexity bias, or if you're a stickler, concavity bias. The hidden harm of fragility is that you need to be much, much better than random in your prediction and knowing where you are going, just to offset the negative effect. Let me summarize the argument. If you have favorable asymmetries or positive convexity, options being a special case, then in the long run you will do reasonably well, outperforming the average in the presence of uncertainty. The more uncertainty, the more role for optionality to kick in, and the more you will outperform. This property is very central to life. Book 6. Via Negativa. Recall that we had no name for the color blue, but managed rather well without it. We stayed for a long part of our history culturally, not biologically, colorblind. And before the composition of Chapter 1, we did not have a name for anti-fragility. Yet systems have relied on it effectively in the absence of human intervention. There are many things without words, matters that we know and can act on, but cannot describe directly, cannot capture in human language or within the narrow human concepts that are available to us. Almost anything around us of significance is hard to grasp linguistically. And in fact, the more powerful, the more incomplete our linguistic grasp. But if we cannot express what something is exactly, we can say something about what it is not, the indirect rather than the direct expression. The apophatic focuses on what cannot be said directly in words, from the Greek apophysis, saying no or mentioning without mentioning. The method began as an avoidance of direct description, leading to a focus on negative description, what is called in Latin via negativa, the negative way, after theological traditions, particularly in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Via negativa does not try to express what God is. Leave that to the primitive brand of contemporary thinkers and philosophers with scientistic tendencies. It just lists what God is not and proceeds by the process of elimination. The idea is mostly associated with the mystical theologian Pseudo-Dionysos the Areopagite. He was some obscure Near Easterner by the name of Dionysos, who wrote powerful mystical treatises and was for a long time confused with Dionysos the Areopagite, a judge in Athens who was converted by the preaching of Paul the Apostle. Hence the qualifier of pseudo added to his name. Neoplatonists are followers of Plato's ideas. They focus mainly on Plato's forms, those abstract objects that had a distinct existence on their own. Pseudo-Dionysos was the disciple of Proclus the Neoplatonist, himself the student of Syrianus, another Syrian Neoplatonist. Proclus was known to repeat the metaphor that statues are carved by subtraction. I have often read a more recent version of the idea, with the following apocryphal pun. Michelangelo was asked by the Pope about the secret of his genius, particularly how he carved the statue of David, largely considered the masterpiece of all masterpieces. His answer was, "It's simple. I just remove everything that is not David." The reader might thus recognize the logic behind the barbell. Remember from the logic of the barbell that it is necessary to first remove fragilities. Where is the charlatan? Recall that the interventionista focuses on positive action, doing. Just like positive definitions, we saw that acts of commission are respected and glorified by our primitive minds and lead to, say, naive government interventions that end in disaster, followed by generalized complaints about naive government interventions, as these, it is now accepted, end in disaster, followed by more naive government interventions. Acts of omission, not doing something, are not considered acts and do not appear to be part of one's mission. Graphic 3 in your PDF showed how generalized this effect can be across domains, from medicine to business. I have used all my life a wonderfully simple heuristic. Charlatans are recognizable in that they will give you positive advice, and only positive advice. Exploiting our gullibility and sucker proneness for recipes that hit you in a flash is just obvious, then evaporate later as you forget them. Just look at the how-to books with, in their title, 10 Steps for, fill in, Enrichment, Weight Loss, Making Friends, Innovation, Getting Elected, Building Muscles, Finding a Husband, Running an Orphanage, etc. Yet in practice, it is the negative that's used by the pros, those selected by evolution. Chess grandmasters usually win by not losing. People become rich by not going bust, particularly when others do. Religions are mostly about interdicts. The learning of life is about what to avoid. You reduce most of your personal risks of accident thanks to a small number of measures. Further, being fooled by randomness is that in most circumstances fraught with a high degree of randomness, one cannot really tell if a successful person has skills, or if a person with skills will succeed, but we can pretty much predict the negative, that a person totally devoid of skills will eventually fail. Subtractive knowledge. Now, when it comes to knowledge, the same applies. The greatest and most robust contribution to knowledge consists in removing what we think is wrong, subtractive epistemology. In life, antifragility is reached by not being a sucker. In Perimystikes Theologias, Pseudo-Dionysos did not use these exact words, nor did he discuss disconfirmation, nor did he get the idea with clarity, but in my view, he figured out the subtractive epistemology and asymmetries in knowledge. I have called Platonicity the love of some crisp abstract forms, the theoretical forms and universals that make us blind to the mess of reality and cause black swan effects. Then I realized that there was an asymmetry. I truly believe in Platonic ideas when they come in reverse, like negative universals. So the central tenet of the epistemology I advocate is as follows. We know a lot more what is wrong than what is right, or, phrased according to the fragile robust classification, negative knowledge, what is wrong, what does not work, is more robust to error than positive knowledge, what is right, what works. So knowledge grows by subtraction much more than by addition, given that what we know today might turn out to be wrong, but what we know to be wrong cannot turn out to be right, at least not easily. If I spot a black swan, not capitalized, I can be quite certain that the statement, all swans are white, is wrong. But even if I have never seen a black swan, I can never hold such a statement to be true. Rephrasing it again, since one small observation can disprove a statement, while millions can hardly confirm it, disconfirmation is more rigorous than confirmation. This idea has been associated in our times with the philosopher Karl Popper, and I quite mistakenly thought that he was its originator, though he is at the origin of an even more potent idea on the fundamental inability to predict the course of history. The notion, it turned out, is vastly more ancient, and was one of the central tenets of the skeptical empirical school of medicine of the post-classical era in the Eastern Mediterranean. It was well known to a group of 19th-century French scholars who rediscovered these works, and this idea of the power of disconfirmation permeates the way we do hard science. As you can see, we can link this to the general tableaus of positive, additive, and negative, subtractive. Negative knowledge is more robust, but it is not perfect. Popper has been criticized by philosophers for his treatment of disconfirmation as hard, unequivocal, black and white. It is not clear-cut. It is impossible to figure out whether an experiment failed to produce the intended results, hence falsifying the theory, because of the failure of the tools, because of bad luck, or because of fraud by the scientist. Say you saw a black swan. That would certainly invalidate the idea that all swans are white. But what if you had been drinking Lebanese wine, or hallucinating from spending too much time on the web? What if it was a dark night in which all swans look gray? Let us say that, in general, failure and disconfirmation are more informative than success and confirmation, which is why I claim that negative knowledge is just more robust. Now, before starting to write this section, I spent some time scouring Popper's complete works, wondering how the great thinker, with his obsessive approach to falsification, completely missed the idea of fragility. His masterpiece, The Poverty of Historicism, in which he presents the limits of forecasting, shows the impossibility of an acceptable representation of the future. But he missed the point that if an incompetent surgeon is operating on a brain, one can safely predict serious damage, even the death of the patient. Yet such subtractive representation of the future is perfectly in line with his idea of disconfirmation, its logical second step. What he calls falsification of a theory should lead, in practice, to the breaking of the object of its application. In political systems, a good mechanism is one that helps remove the bad guy. It's not about what to do or who to put in, for the bad guy can cause more harm than the collective actions of good ones. John Elster goes further. He recently wrote a book with the telling title, Preventing Mischief, in which he bases negative action on Bentham's idea that the art of the legislator is limited to the prevention of everything that might prevent the development of their, members of the assembly, liberty and their intelligence. And, as expected, via negativa is part of classical wisdom. For the Arab scholar and religious leader Ali bin Abi Taleb, no relation, keeping one's distance from an ignorant person is equivalent to keeping company with a wise man. Finally, consider this modernized version in a saying from Steve Jobs. People think focus means saying yes to the thing you've got to focus on, but that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the 100 other good ideas that there are. You have to pick carefully. I'm actually as proud of the things we haven't done as the things I have done. Innovation is saying no to 1,000 things. Barbells, again. Subtractive knowledge is a form of barbell. Critically, it is convex. What is wrong is quite robust. What you don't know is fragile and speculative. But you do not take it seriously, so you make sure it does not harm you in case it turns out to be false. Now another application of via negativa lies in the less is more idea. Less is more. The less is more idea in decision-making can be traced to Spiros Makridakis, Robin Dawes, Dan Goldstein, and Gerd Gigerenzer, who have all found in various contexts that simpler methods for forecasting and inference can work much, much better than complicated ones. Their simple rules of thumb are not perfect, but are designed to not be perfect. Adopting some intellectual humility and abandoning the aim at sophistication can yield powerful effects. The pair of Goldstein and Gigerenzer coined the notion of fast and frugal heuristics that make good decisions despite limited time, knowledge, and computing power. I realized that the less is more heuristic fell squarely into my work in two places. First, extreme effects. There are domains in which the rare event, I repeat, good or bad, plays a disproportionate share, and we tend to be blind to it. So focusing on the exploitation of such a rare event, or protection against it, changes a lot of the risky exposure. Just worry about black swan exposures, and life is easy. Less is more has proved to be shockingly easy to find and apply, and robust to mistakes and change of minds. There may not be an easily identifiable cause for a large share of the problems, but often there is an easy solution. Not to all problems, but good enough. I mean really good enough. And such a solution is immediately identifiable, sometimes with the naked eye rather than the use of complicated analyses and highly fragile, error-prone, cause-ferreting nerdiness. Some people are aware of the 80-20 idea, based on the discovery by Vilfredo Pareto more than a century ago that 20% of the people in Italy owned 80% of the land, and vice versa. Of these 20%, 20%, that is, 4%, would have owned around 80% of the 80%, that is, 64%. We end up with less than 1% representing about 50% of the total. These describe winner-take-all extremiston effects. These effects are very general, from the distribution of wealth to book sales per author. Few realize that we are moving into the far more uneven distribution of 99-1 across many things that used to be 80-20. 99% of internet traffic is attributable to less than 1% of sites. 99% of book sales come from less than 1% of authors. And I need to stop, because numbers are emotionally stirring. Almost everything contemporary has winner-take-all effects, which includes sources of harm and benefits. Accordingly, as I will show, 1% modification of systems can lower fragility, or increase anti-fragility, by about 99%. And all it takes is a few steps, very few steps, often at low cost, to make things better and safer. For instance, a small number of homeless people cost the states a disproportionate share of the bills, which makes it obvious where to look for the savings. A small number of employees in a corporation cause the most problems, corrupt the general attitude, and vice versa. So getting rid of these is a great solution. A small number of customers generate a large share of the revenues. I get 95% of my smear postings from the same three obsessive persons, all representing the same prototypes of failure. One of whom has written, I estimate, close to 100,000 words in posts. He needs to write more and more and find more and more stuff to critique in my work and personality to get the same effect. When it comes to health care, Ezekiel Emanuel showed that half the population accounts for less than 3% of the costs, with the sickest 10% consuming 64% of the total pie. Bent Flupiao of Chapter 18 showed in his Black Swan Management idea that the bulk of cost overruns by corporations are simply attributable to large technology projects, implying that that's what we need to focus on instead of talking and talking and writing complicated papers. As they say in the Mafia, just work on removing the pebble in your shoe. There are some domains, like, say, real estate, in which problems and solutions are crisply summarized by a heuristic, a rule of thumb to look for the three most important properties, location, location, and location. Much of the rest is supposed to be chicken shit. Not quite, and not always true, but it shows the central thing to worry about, as the rest takes care of itself. Yet people want more data to solve problems. I once testified in Congress against a project to fund a crisis forecasting project. The people involved were blind to the paradox that we have never had more data than we have now, yet have less predictability than ever. More data, such as paying attention to the eye colors of the people around when crossing the street, can make you miss the big truck. When you cross the street, you remove data, anything but the essential threat. As Paul Valéry once wrote, que de choses il faut ignorer pour agir. How many things one should disregard in order to act. Convincing and confident disciplines, say physics, tend to use little statistical backup, while political science and economics, which have never produced anything of note, are full of elaborate statistics and statistical evidence. And you know that once you remove the smoke, the evidence is not evidence. The situation in science is similar to detective novels, in which the person with the largest number of alibis turns out to be the guilty one. And you do not need reams of paper full of data to destroy the megatons of papers using statistics and economics. The simple argument that black swans and tail events run the socioeconomic world, and these events cannot be predicted, is sufficient to invalidate their statistics. We have further evidence of the potency of less is more from the following experiment. Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons, in their book The Invisible Gorilla, show how people watching a video of a basketball game, when diverted with attention-absorbing details such as counting passes, can completely miss a gorilla stepping into the middle of the court. I discovered that I had been intuitively using the less is more idea as an aid in decision-making, contrary to the method of putting a series of pros and cons side by side on a computer screen. For instance, if you have more than one reason to do something, choose a doctor or veterinarian, hire a gardener or an employee, marry a person, go on a trip, just don't do it. It does not mean that one reason is better than two, just that by invoking more than one reason, you are trying to convince yourself to do something. Obvious decisions, robust to error, require no more than a single reason. Likewise, the French army had a heuristic to reject excuses for absenteeism for more than one reason, like death of grandmother, cold virus, and being bitten by a boar. If someone attacks a book or idea using more than one argument, you know it is not real. Nobody says, he is a criminal, he killed many people, and he also has bad table manners and bad breath and is a very poor driver. I have often followed what I call Bergson's razor. A philosopher should be known for one single idea, not more. I can't source it to Bergson, but the rule is good enough. The French essayist and poet Paul Valéry once asked Einstein if he carried a notebook to write down ideas. I never have ideas, was the reply. In fact, he just did not have chicken shit ideas. So, a heuristic. If someone has a long bio, I skip him. At a conference, a friend invited me to have lunch with an overachieving hotshot whose resume can cover more than two or three lives. I skipped to sit at a table with the trainees and stage engineers. Likewise, when I am told that someone has 300 academic papers and 22 honorary doctorates, but no other single compelling contribution or main idea behind it, I avoid him like the bubonic plague. Chapter 20. Neomania. Looking at the future by via negativa. The Lindy effect. The old outlives the new in proportion to its age. Empedocles' tile. Why the irrational has an edge over the perceived to be rational. Time and fragility. Prophecy, like knowledge, is subtractive, not additive. The Lindy effect, or how the old prevails over the new, especially in technology, no matter what they say in California. Prophecy, not a recommended and voluntary career. Anti-fragility implies, contrary to initial instinct, that the old is superior to the new, and much more than you think. No matter how something looks to your intellectual machinery, or how well or poorly it narrates, time will know more about its fragilities, and break it when necessary. Here I expose a contemporary disease, linked to interventionism, called neomania, which brings fragility, but I believe may be treatable if one is patient enough. What survives must be good at serving some mostly hidden purpose that time can see, but our eyes and logical faculties can't capture. In this chapter, we use the notion of fragility as a central driver of prediction. Recall the foundational asymmetry. The anti-fragile benefits from volatility and disorder. The fragile is harmed. Well, time is the same as disorder. From Simonides to Jensen. As an exercise in the use of the distinction between fragility and anti-fragility, let us play prophet, with the understanding that it is not a good career choice unless you have a thick skin, a good circle of friends, little access to the internet, a library with a good set of ancient proverbs, and, if possible, the ability to derive personal benefits from your prophecy. As shown from the track record of the prophets, before you are proven right, you will be reviled. After you are proven right, you will be hated for a while, or, what's worse, your ideas will appear to be trivial, thanks to retrospective distortion. This makes it far more convincing to follow the Fat Tony method of focusing on shekels more than recognition. And such treatment has continued in modern times. 20th century intellectuals who have embraced the wrong ideas, such as communism or even Stalinism, have remained fashionable, and their books remain on the bookstore shelves, while those who, like the political philosopher Raymond Aron, saw the problems, got short shrift both before and after being acknowledged.